yourself comparatively late in life," the judge said, clearing his throat. "At least, that is how he strikes me. Men who find themselves late are never sure. They are all the things the civics books tell us the good citizens should be, partisans but never zealots, respecters of the facts which attend each situation but never benders of those facts, uncomfortable in positions of leadership but rarely able to turn down a responsibility once it has been offered, or thrust upon them. They make the best leaders in a democracy because they are unlikely to fall in love with power, quite the opposite. And when things go wrong, when a Mrs. Volman dies—" "Could it have been diabetes?" the judge interrupted himself. "I think it likely. The cyanosed skin, the fast drop into a coma. Possibly, possibly. But if so, where was her insulin? Might she have let herself die? Could it have been suicide?" The judge lapsed into a thinking pause, hands clasped under his chin. He looked like a brooding black bird of prey. "You were going to say something about when things go wrong," Lucy prompted gently. "When they go wrong, when a Sally Volman dies of diabetes or internal bleeding or whatever, a man like Larry blames himself. The men the civics books idolize rarely come to good ends. Melvin Purvis, the super G-man of the 30s, shot himself with his own service pistol in 1959. When Lincoln was assassinated, he was a prematurely old man tottering on the edge of a nervous breakdown. We used to watch presidents decay before our very eyes from month to month and even week to week on national TV. Except for Nixon, of course, who thrived on power the way that a vampire bat thrives on blood, and Reagan, who seemed a little too stupid to get old. I guess Gerald Ford was that way, too." "I think there's something more," Lucy said sadly. He looked at her, inquiring. "How did it go? I am full of tossings and turnings unto the dawning of the day." He nodded. Lucy said, "Pretty good description of a man in love, isn't it?" He looked at her, surprised that she had known all along about the thing he wouldn't say. Lucy shrugged, smiled, a bitter quirk of the lips. "Women know," she said. "Women almost always know." Before he could reply, she had drifted away toward the road where Larry would be, sitting and thinking about Nadine Cross. "Larry?"
"Here,"
he said briefly. "What are you doing up?"
"I got cold," she said.
He was sitting cross-legged on the shoulder of the road, as if in meditation.
"Room for me?"
"Sure." He moved over. The boulder still held a bit of warmth from the day, which was now passing. She sat down. He slipped an arm around her. According to Lucy's estimation, they were about 50 miles east of Boulder tonight. If they could get on the road by 9 tomorrow, they would be in the Boulder Free Zone for lunch. It was the man on the radio who called it the Boulder Free Zone. His name was Ralph Brentner, and he said, with some embarrassment, that the Boulder Free Zone was mostly a radio call sign, but Lucy liked it just for itself, for the way it sounded. It sounded right. It sounded like a fresh start. And Nadine Cross had adopted the name with an almost religious zeal, as if it was talismanic. 3 days after Larry, Nadine, Joe, and Lucy had arrived at Stovington and found the plague center deserted, Nadine had suggested they pick up a CB radio and start conning the 40 channels. Larry had accepted the idea wholeheartedly, the way he accepted most of her ideas, Lucy thought. She didn't understand Nadine Cross at all. Larry was stuck on her, that was obvious, but Nadine didn't want to have much to do with him outside of each day's routine. Anyway, the CB idea had been a good one, even if the brain that had produced it was ice-locked, except when it came to Joe. It would be the easiest way to locate other groups, Nadine had said, and to agree upon a rendezvous. This had led to some puzzled discussion in their group, which at that time had numbered half a dozen with the addition of Mark Zellman, who had been a welder in upstate New York, and Lori Constable, a 26-year-old nurse. And the puzzled discussion had led to yet another upsetting argument about the dreams. Lori had begun by protesting that they knew exactly where they were going. They were following the resourceful Harold Lauder and his party to Nebraska. Of course they were, and for the same reason, The force of the dreams was simply too powerful to be denied. After some back and forth on this, Nadine had gotten hysterical. She had had no dreams. Repeat, no goddamn dreams. If the others wanted to practice auto-hypnosis on each other, fine. As long as there was some rational basis for pushing on to Nebraska, such as the sign at the Stovington installation, fine. But she wanted it understood that she wasn't going along on the basis of a lot of metaphysical bullshit. If it was all the same to them, she would place her faith in radios, not visions. Mark had turned a friendly, gapped grin on Nadine's strained countenance and said, "If you ain't had no dreams, how come you woke me up last night talking in your sleep?" Nadine had gone paper white. "Are you calling me a liar?" she nearly screamed. "Because if you are, one of us had better leave right now." Joe shrank close to her, whimpering. Larry had smoothed it over, agreeing with the CB idea, and in the last week or so they had begun to pick up broadcasts, not from Nebraska, which had been abandoned even before they got there. The dreams had told them that, but even then the dreams had been fading, losing their urgency. But from Boulder, Colorado, 600 miles farther west, signals boosted by Ralph's powerful transmitter. Lucy could still remember the joyous, almost ecstatic faces of the others as Ralph Brentner's drawling Oklahoma accent had cut nasally through the static. "This is Ralph Brentner, Boulder Free Zone. If you hear me, reply on Channel 14. Repeat, Channel 14. They could hear Ralph, but had no transmitter powerful enough to acknowledge. Not then. But they had drawn closer, and since that first transmission they had found out that the old woman, Abigail Fremantle by name, but Lucy herself would always think of her as Mother Abigail, and her party had been the first to arrive, but since then people had been straggling in by twos and threes and in groups as large as 30. There had been 200 people in Boulder when Brentner first got in contact with them. This evening, as they chattered back and forth, their own CB now an easy reaching distance, there were over 350. Their own group would send that number well on the way to 400. "Penny for your thoughts," Lucy said to Larry and put her hand on his arm. "I was thinking about that watch and the death of capitalism," he said, pointing at her pulsar. "It used to be root, hog, or die, and the hog who rooted the hardest ended up with the red, white, and blue Cadillac and the pulsar watch. Now, true democracy. Any lady in America can have a pulsar digital and a blue haze mink." He laughed. "Maybe," she said. "But I'll tell you something, Larry. I may not know much about capitalism, but I know something about this $1,000 watch. I know it's no damned good." "No?" He looked at her, surprised and smiling. It was just a little one, but it was genuine. She was glad to see his smile, a smile that was for her. "Why not?" "Because no one knows what time it is," Lucy said pertly. 4 or 5 days ago, I asked Mr. Jackson and Mark and you, one right after another, and you all gave me different times, and you all said that your watches had stopped at least once. Remember that place where they kept the world's time? I read an article about it in a magazine one time when I was in the doctor's office. It was tremendous. They had it right down to the micro-microsecond. They had pendulums and solar clocks and everything. Now I think about that place sometimes, and it just makes me mad. All the clocks there must be stopped, and I have a $1,000 pulsar watch that I hawked from a jewelry store, and it can't keep time down to the solar second like it's supposed to, because of the flu. The goddamned flu." She fell silent, and they sat together a while without talking. Then Larry pointed at the sky. "See there?"
"What? Where?"
3 o'clock high. 2 now." She looked, but didn't see what he had pointed at until he pressed his warm hands to the sides of her face and tilted it toward the right quadrant of the sky. Then she did see, and her breath caught in her throat. A bright light, star bright, but hard and unwinking. It fled rapidly across the sky on an east-to-west course.
"My God!" she cried. "It's a plane, isn't it, Larry? A plane?"
"No, an Earth satellite. It'll be going around and around up there for the next 700 years, probably." They sat and watched it until it was out of sight behind the dark bulk of the Rockies.
"Larry," she said softly,
"why didn't Nadine admit it, about the dreams?
There was a barely perceptible stiffening in him, making her wish she hadn't brought it up. But now that she had, she was determined to pursue it, unless he cut her off entirely.
She says she doesn't have any dreams.
She does have them, though. Mark was right about that. And she talks in her sleep. She was so loud one night she woke me up. He was looking at her now. After a long time, he asked, "What was she saying?"
Lucy thought, trying to get it just right.
"She was thrashing around in her sleeping bag, and she was saying over and over, 'Don't. It's so cold, don't. I can't stand it if you do. It's so cold, so cold.' And then she started to pull her hair. She started to pull her own hair in her sleep, and moan. It gave me the creeps."
"People can have nightmares, Lucy. That doesn't mean they're about, well, about him."
"It's better not to say much about him after dark, isn't it?"
"Better, yes."
"She acts as if she's coming unraveled, Larry. Do you know what I mean?"
"Yes." He knew, in spite of her insistence that she didn't dream. There had been brown circles under her eyes by the time they reached Hemmingford home. That magnificent cable of heavy hair was noticeably whiter, and if you touched her, she jumped. She flinched.
Lucy said, "You love her, don't you?"
"Oh, Lucy," he said reproachfully.
"No, I just want you to know."
She shook her head violently at his expression.
"I have to say this. I see the way you look at her, the way she looks at you sometimes, when you're busy with something else and it's safe. She loves you, Larry, but she's afraid."
"Afraid of what?
Afraid of what?"
He was remembering his attempt to make love to her 3 days after the Stovington fiasco. Since then, she had grown quiet. She was still cheerful on occasion, but now she was quite obviously laboring to be cheerful. Joe had been asleep. Larry had gone to sit beside her, and for a while they had talked, not about their current situation, but about the old things, the safe things. Larry had tried to kiss her. She pushed him away, turning her head, but not before he had felt the things Lucy had just told him. He had tried again, being rough and gentle at the same time, wanting her so damn badly. And for just one moment she had given in to him, had shown him what it could be like if... Then she broke from him and moved away, her face pale, her arms strapped across her breasts, hands cupping elbows, head lowered.
"Don't do that again, Larry. Please don't, or I'll have to take Joe and leave."
"Why? Why, Nadine? Why does it have to be such a goddamn big deal?" She hadn't answered, simply stood in that head-down posture, the brown bruised places already beginning beneath her eyes.
"If I could tell you, I would," she said finally, and walked away without looking back.
"I had a girlfriend once who acted a little like her," Lucy said. "My senior year in high school. Her name was Jolene. Jolene Majors. Jolene wasn't in high school. She dropped out to marry her boyfriend. He was in the Navy. She was pregnant when they got married, but she lost the baby. Her man was gone a lot, and Jolene, she liked to party down. She liked that, and her man was a regular jealous bear. He told her if he ever found out she was doing anything behind his back, he'd break both of her arms and spoil her face. Can you imagine what that life must have been like? Her husband comes home and says, 'Well, I'm shipping out now, love. Give me a kiss, and then we'll have a little roll in the hay. And by the way, if I come back and someone tells me you've been messing around, I'll break both your arms and spoil your face.'" "Yeah, that's not so great."
"So after a while, she met this guy," Lucy said. "He was the assistant phys ed coach at Burlington High. They snuck around, always looking over their shoulders. And I don't know if her husband had set someone up to spy on them, but after a while it didn't matter. After a while, Jolene got really flaky. She'd think that some guy waiting for a bus on the corner was one of her husband's friends, or the salesman checking in behind her and Herb at some flea-bag motel was. She'd think that even if the motel was somewhere way down in New York State, or even the cop who gave them directions to a picnic spot when they were together. It got so bad, she'd give a little scream if a door slammed in the wind, and she'd jump every time someone came up her stairs. And since she was living in a place that was split up into 7 little apartments, someone was almost always coming up the stairs. Herb got scared and left her. He didn't get scared of Jolene's husband. He got scared of her. And just before her husband came back on leave, Jolene had a nervous breakdown, all because she liked to love a little too much. And because he was crazy jealous. Nadine reminds me of that girl, Larry. I'm sorry for her. I don't like her that much, I guess, but I sure am sorry for her. She looks terrible.
Are you saying Nadine is afraid of me the way that girl was afraid of her husband? Lucy said,
Maybe.
I'll tell you this. Wherever Nadine's husband is, he's not here. He laughed a little uneasily. We ought to go back to bed. Tomorrow's going to be a heavy day.
Yes, she said, thinking he hadn't understood a word she said.
And suddenly she burst into tears.
Hey, he said, hey.
He tried to put an arm around her. She struck it off.
You're getting what you want from me. You don't have to do that.
There was still enough of the old Larry in him to wonder if her voice would carry back to camp.
Lucy, I never twisted your arm, he said grimly.
Oh, you're so stupid, she cried and beat at his leg.
Why are men so stupid, Larry? All you can see is what's in black and white. No, you never twisted my arm. I ain't like her. You could twist her arm and she'd still spit in your eye and cross her legs.
Men have names for girls like me. They write them on bathroom stalls, I've heard. But all it is needing someone warm, needing to be warm, needing to love. Is that so bad?
No, it isn't. But Lucy, but you don't believe that, she said scornfully. So you go on chasing Miss High Pockets, and in the meantime you got Lucy to do the horizontal bop with when the sun goes down.
He sat quietly, nodding. It was true, every word of it. He was too tired, too Christless beat to argue against it. She seemed to see that. Her face softened, and she put a hand on his arm.
If you catch her, Larry, I'll be the first to throw you a bouquet. I never held a grudge in my life. Just try not to be too disappointed.
Lucy. Her voice rose suddenly, rough with unexpected power, and for a moment his arms goose-fleshed.
I just happen to think love is very important. Only love will get us through this. Good connections. It's hate against us. Worse, it's emptiness.
Her voice dropped.
You're right. It's late. I'm going back to bed. Coming?
Yes, he said. And as they stood up, he took her in his arms with no calculation at all and kissed her firmly. I love you as much as I can, Lucy.
I know that, she said, and gave him a tired smile. I know that, Larry.
This time, when he put his arm around her, she let it stay. They walked back to camp together, made diffident love, slept. Nadine came awake like a cat in the dark some 20 minutes after Larry Underwood and Lucy Swan had come back to camp, 10 minutes after they had finished their act of love and drifted off to sleep. The high iron of terror sang in her veins.
Someone wants me, she thought, listening as the mill race of her heart slowed.
Her eyes, wide and full of darkness, stared up to where the overhanging branches of an elm laced the sky with shadows.
There's that. Someone wants me. It's true. But it's so cold.
Her parents and her brother had been killed in a car accident when she was 6. She hadn't gone along that day to see her aunt and uncle, staying behind instead to play with a friend from down the street. They had liked her brother best anyway, she could remember that. Brother hadn't been like her, little halfling stolen from an orphanage cradle at the age of 4.5 months. Brother's origins had been clear. Brother had been, trumpets please, their own. But Nadine had always and forever belonged only to Nadine. She was the Earth's child. After the accident, she had gone to live with the aunt and uncle because they were the only two relatives, the White Mountains of eastern New Hampshire. She remembered that they had taken her for a ride on the Cog Railway up Mount Washington for her 8th birthday, and the altitude had caused a bloody nose, and they had been angry with her. Aunt and uncle were too old. They had been in their mid-50s when she turned 16. the year she had run fleetly through the dewy grass under the moon. The night of wine, when dreams condensed out of thin air like the night milk of fantasy. A love night. And if the boy caught her, she would have given him whatever prizes were hers to give. And what did it matter if he caught her? They had run, wasn't that the important thing? But he hadn't caught her. A cloud had drifted over the moon. The dew began to feel clammy and unpleasant, frightening. The taste of wine in her mouth had somehow changed to the taste of electric spit, slightly sour. A kind of metamorphosis had taken place, a feeling that she should, must, wait. And where had he been then, her intended, her dark bridegroom? On what streets, what back roads, clocking along in outside suburban darkness, while inside the brittle clink of cocktail chatter broke the world into neat and rational sections? What cold winds were his? How many sticks of dynamite in his frayed pack sack? Who knew what his name had been when she was 16? How ancient was he? Where had been his home? What sort of mother had held him to her breast? She was only sure that he was an orphan as she was, his time still to come. He walked mostly on roads that hadn't even been laid down yet, while she had but one foot on those same roads. The junction where they would meet was far ahead. He was an American man, she knew that, a man who would have a taste for milk and apple pie, a man who would appreciate the homely beauty of red check and gingham. His home was America, and his ways were the secret ways, the highways in hiding, the underground railways where directions are written in runes. He was the other man, the other face, the hard case, the dark man, the walkin' dude, and his run-down boot heels clocked along the perfumed ways of the summer night. Who knoweth when the bridegroom comes? She had waited for him, the unbroken vessel. At 16 she had almost fallen, and again in college. Both of them had gone away angry and perplexed, the way Larry was now, sensing the crossroads inside her, the sense of some preordained mystic junction point. Boulder was the place where the roads diverged. The time was close. He had called. Bid her come. After college, she had buried herself in her work, had shared a rented house with two other girls. What two girls? Well, they came and went. Only Nadine stayed, and she was pleasant to the young men her changing roommates brought home. But she never had a young man herself. She supposed they talked about her, called her spinster-in-waiting, maybe even conjectured that she might be a carefully circumspect lesbian. It wasn't true. She was simply unbroken, waiting. It had seemed to her sometimes that a change was coming. She would be putting toys away in the silent classroom at the end of the day, and suddenly she would pause, her eyes lambent and watchful, a jack-in-the-box held forgotten in one hand. And she would think, a change is coming. A great wind is going to blow. Sometimes, when such a thought came to her, she would find herself looking back over her shoulder like something pursued. Then it would break, and she would laugh uneasily. Her hair had begun to gray in her 16th year, the year she had been chased and not caught. Just a few strands at first, startlingly visible in all the black. And not gray, no, that was the wrong word. White. It had been white. Years later, she had attended a party in the basement lounge of a frat house. The lights had been low, and after a while the people had drifted away by twos. Many of the girls, Nadine among them, had signed out for overnight from their dorms. She had fully intended to go through with it, but something that was still buried beneath the months and years had held her back. And the next morning, in the cold light of 7 a.m., she had looked at herself in one of a long line of dormitory bathroom mirrors and saw that the white had advanced again, seemingly overnight, although that, of course, was impossible. And so the years had passed, ticking away like seasons in a dry age. And there had been feelings, yes, feelings, and sometimes in the dead grave of night she had awakened both hot and cold, bathed in sweat, deliciously alive and aware in the trench of her bed, thinking of weird dark sex in a kind of gutter ecstasy, rolling in hot liquid, coming and biting at the same time. and the mornings after she would go to the mirror, and she would fancy that she saw more white there. Through those years she was outwardly only Nadine Cross, sweet, good with the children, good at her job, single. Once such a woman would have caused comment and curiosity in the community, but times had changed, and her beauty was so singular that it somehow seemed perfectly right for her to be just as she was. Now times were going to change again. Now the change was coming, and in her dreams she had begun to know her bridegroom, to understand him a little, even though she had never seen his face. He was the one she had been waiting for. She wanted to go to him, but she didn't want to. She was meant for him, but he terrified her. Then Joe had come, and after him, Larry. Things had become terribly complicated then. She began to feel like a prize ring in a tug-of-war rope. She knew that her purity, her virginity, was somehow important to the dark man, that if she let Larry have her, or if she let any man have her, the dark enchantment would end. And she was attracted to Larry. She had set out quite deliberately to let him have her. Again, she had intended to go through with it. Let him have her. Let it end. Let it all end. She was tired, and Larry was right. She had waited too long for the other one, through too many dry years. But Larry was not right, or so it had seemed at first. She had brushed his initial advances away with a kind of contempt, the way a mare might switch at a fly with her tail. She could remember thinking, if that's all there is to him, who could blame me for rejecting his suit? She had followed him, though. That was a fact. But she had been frantic to reach other people, not just because of Joe, but because she had come almost to the point of deserting the boy and striking west on her own to find the man. Only years of ingrained responsibility to the children who had been placed under her care had kept her from doing that, and her knowledge that, left on his own, Joe would die. In a world where so many have died, to parcel out more death is surely the gravest sin. So she had gone with Larry, who was, after all, better than nothing or no one. But it had turned out that there was a great deal more to Larry Underwood than nothing or no one. He was like one of those optical illusions, maybe even to himself, where the water looks shallow, only an inch or two deep, but when you put your hand in, you've suddenly got your arm wet to the shoulder. The way he had gotten to know Joe, that was one thing. The way Joe had taken to him was another. Her own jealous reaction to the growing relationship between Joe and Larry was a third. At the motorcycle dealership in Wells, Larry had bet the fingers of both hands on the boy, and he had won. If they had not been concentrating their full attention on the lid covering the gasoline tank, they would have seen her mouth drop open in a slack O of surprise. She had stood watching them, unable to move, her gaze concentrated on the bright metal line of the crowbar, waiting for it to first jitter and then fall away. She only realized after it was over that she had been waiting for the screams to begin. Then the lid was up and over, and she was faced with her own error in judgment, an error so deep it was fundamental. In that case, he had known Joe better than she, and without any special training and on much shorter notice. Only hindsight allowed her to understand how important the guitar episode had been, how quickly and fundamentally it had defined Larry's relationship with Joe. And what was at the center of that relationship? Why, dependence, of course. What else could have caused that sudden jangle of jealousy all through her system? If Joe had depended on Larry, that would have been one thing, normal and acceptable. What had upset her was that Larry also depended on Joe, needed Joe in a way she didn't. And Joe knew it. Had her judgment been that wrong about Larry's character? She thought now that the answer was yes. That nervous, self-serving exterior was a veneer, and it was being worn away by hard use. Just the fact that he had held them all together on this long trip spoke for his determination. The conclusion seemed clear. Beneath her decision to let Larry make love to her, a part of her was still committed to the other man, and making love to Larry would be like killing that part of herself forever. She wasn't sure she could do that. And she wasn't the only one who had dreamed of the dark man now. That had disturbed her at first, then frightened her. Fright was all it was when she had only Joe and Larry to compare notes with, When they met Lucy Swan and she said she'd had the same sort of dream, fright became a kind of frenzied terror. It was no longer possible to tell herself their dreams only sounded like hers. What if everyone left was having them? What if the Dark Man's time had come around at last, not just for her, but for everyone left on the planet? This idea, more than any other, raised the conflicting emotions of utter terror and strong attraction within her. She had held to the idea of Stovington with a nearly panicky grip. It stood, by nature of its function, as a symbol of sanity and rationality against the rising tide of dark magic she felt around her. But Stovington had been deserted, a mockery of the safe haven she had built it up to be in her mind. The symbol of sanity and rationality was a death house. As they moved west, picking up survivors, her hope that it could somehow end for her without confrontation had gradually died. It died as Larry grew in her estimation. He was sleeping with Lucy Swan now, but what did that matter? She was spoken for. The others had been having two opposing dreams, the Dark Man and the Old Woman. The Old Woman seemed to stand for some sort of elemental force, just as the Dark Man did. The Old Woman was the nucleus the others were gradually cohering around. Nadine had never dreamed of her, only of the Dark Man. And when the dreams of the others had suddenly faded away as inexplicably as they had come, her own dreams had seemed to grow in power and in clarity. She knew many things which they did not. The Dark Man's name was Randall Flagg. Those in the West who opposed him or went against his way of doing things had either been crucified or driven mad somehow and set free to wander in the boiling sink of Death Valley. There were small groups of technical people in San Francisco and Los Angeles, but they were only temporary. Very soon they would be moving to Las Vegas, where the main concentration of people was growing. For him, there was no hurry. Summer was on the downside now. Soon the Rocky Mountain passes would be filling with snow, and while there were plows to clear them, they would not be able to spare enough warm bodies to man the plows. There would be a long winter in which to consolidate, and next April, or May. Nadine lay in the dark, looking up at the sky. Boulder was her last hope. The Old Woman was her last hope. The sanity and rationality she had hoped to find at Stovington had begun to form in Boulder. They were good, she thought, the good guys, and if only it could be that simple for her, caught in her crazy web of conflicting desires. Played over and over again like a dominant chord was her own firm belief that murder in this decimated world was the gravest sin, and her heart told her firmly and without question that death was Randall Flagg's business. But oh, how she wanted his cold kiss, more than she had wanted the kisses of the high school boy, or the college boy. Even more, she feared, than Larry Underwood's kiss and embrace. "We'll be in Boulder tomorrow," she thought. "Maybe I'll know then if the trip is over, or—" A shooting star scratched its fire across the sky, and like a child, she wished on it. Chapter 50. Dawn was coming up, painting the eastern sky a delicate rose color. Stu Redman and Glenn Bateman were about halfway up Flagstaff Mountain in West Boulder, where the first foothills of the Rockies rise up out of the flat plains like a vision of prehistory. In the dawn light, Stu thought that the pines crawling between the naked and nearly perpendicular stone faces looked like the veins ridging some giant's hand that had poked out of the earth. Somewhere to the east, Nadine Cross was at last falling into a thin, unsatisfactory sleep. "I'm going to have a headache this afternoon," Glenn said. "I don't believe I've stayed up drinking all night since I was an undergrad." "Sunrise is worth it," Stu said. "Yes, it is. Beautiful. Have you ever been in the Rockies before?" "Nope," Stu said. "But I'm glad I came." He hoisted the jug of wine and had a swallow. "I got quite a buzz on myself." He looked out over the view in silence for a few moments and then turned to Glenn with a slanted smile. "What's going to happen now?" "Happen?" Glenn raised his eyebrows. "Sure.
That's why I got you up here. Told Franny I'm going to get him good and drunk and then pick his brains. She said fine. Glenn grinned. There are no tea leaves in the bottom of a wine bottle. No, but she explained to me just what it is you used to be. Sociology, the study of group interaction. So make some educated guesses. Cross my palm with silver, O aspirant to knowledge. Never mind the silver, Baldy. I'll take you down to the First National Bank of Boulder tomorrow and give you $1 million. How's that? Seriously, Stu, what do you want to know? Same things that mute guy Andros wants to know, I guess. What's going to happen next? I don't know how to put it any better than that. There's going to be a society, Glenn said slowly. What kind? Impossible to say right now. I'd guess from the rate they've been coming in, or every day, that by the 1st of September there'll be 1,500 of us. 4,500 by the 1st of October, and maybe as many as 8,000 by the time the snow flies in November and closes the roads. Write that down as prediction number one. To Glenn's amusement, Stu did indeed produce a notebook from the back pocket of his jeans and jotted down what he had just said. Hard for me to believe, Stu said. We came all the way across the country and didn't see 100 people, all told. Yes, but they're coming in, aren't they? Yes, in dribs and drabs. In what's and what's? Glenn asked, grinning. Dribs and drabs. My mother used to say that. You shitting on my mom's way of talking. The day will never come in when I lose enough respect for my own hide to shit on a Texan's mother, Stuart. Well, they're coming in, sure. Ralph's in touch with 5 or 6 groups right now that will bring us up to 500 by the end of the week. Glenn smiled again. Yes, and Mother Abigail sits right there with him in his radio station, but she won't talk on the CB. Says she's afraid she'll get an electroshock. Franny loves that old woman, Stu said. Part of it is because she knows so much about delivering babies, but part of it is just loving her, you know. Yes, most everybody feels the same. 8,000 people by winter, Stu said, returning to the original topic. Man, oh man. It's just arithmetic. Let's say the flu wiped out 99% of the population. Maybe it wasn't that bad, but let's use that figure just so we have a place to put our feet. If the flu was 99% fatal, that means it wiped out damn near 218 million people just in this country. He looked at Stu's shocked face and nodded grimly. Maybe it wasn't that bad, but we can make a pretty good guess that figure's in the ballpark. Makes the Nazis look like pikers, doesn't it? My lord, Stu said in a dry voice. But that would still leave over 2 million people, a fifth of the pre-plague population of Tokyo, a fourth of the pre-plague population of New York. That's in this country alone. Now, I believe that 10% of that 2 million might not have survived the aftermath of the flu, folks who fell victims to what I'd call the aftershock, people like poor Mark Braddock with his burst appendix, but also the accidents, the suicides, yes, and murder, too. That takes us down to 1.8 million. But we suspect there's an adversary, don't we? The dark man that we dreamed about. West of us somewhere. There are 7 states over there that could legitimately be called his territory, if he really exists. I guess he exists all right, Stu said. My feeling, too. But is he simply in dominion of all the people over there? I don't think so, any more than Mother Abigail is automatically in dominion over the people in the other 41 continental United States. I think things have been in a state of slow flux, and that state of affairs is beginning to end. People are cohering. When you and I first discussed this back in New Hampshire, I envisioned dozens of little tin-pot societies. What I didn't count on, because I didn't know about it, was the all but irresistible pull of these 2 opposing dreams. It was a new fact that no one could have foreseen. Are you saying that we'll end up with 900,000 people and he'll end up with 900,000? No. First, the coming winter is going to take its toll. It's going to take it here, and it's going to be even tougher for the small groups that don't make it here before the snow. You realize we don't even have 1 doctor in the free zone yet? Our medical staff consists of a veterinarian and Mother Abigail herself,
who's forgotten more valid folk medicine than you or I will ever have a chance to learn. Still, they'd look cute trying to put a steel plate in your skull after you took a fall and bashed in the back of your head, wouldn't they? Stu snickered. That old boy Rolf Danamont would probably drag out his Remington and let daylight through me. I'd guess the total American population might be down to 1.6 million by next spring, and that's a kind estimate. Of that number, I'd like to hope we get the million. A million people, Stu said, awed. He looked out over the sprawling, mostly deserted city of Boulder, now brightening as the sun began to hoist itself over the flat eastern horizon. I just can't picture that. This town would be busting at the seams. Boulder couldn't hold them. I know that boggles the mind when you walk around the empty streets downtown and out toward Table Mesa, but it just couldn't. We'd have to seed the communities around us. The situation you'd have is this one giant community and the rest of the country east of here absolutely empty. Why do you think we'd get most of the people? For a very unscientific reason, Glenn said, riffling his tonsure of hair with one hand. I like to believe most people are good, and I believe that whoever is running the show west of us is really bad. But I have a hunch. He trailed off. Go on, spill it. I will because I'm drunk, but it stays between us, Stuart. All right. Your word? My word, Stu said. I think he's going to get most of the techies, Glenn said finally. Don't ask me why, it's just a hunch. Except that tech people like to work in an atmosphere of tight discipline and linear goals, for the most part. They like it when the trains run on time. What we've got here in Boulder right now is mass confusion, everyone bopping along and doing his own thing. And we've got to do something about what my students would have called getting our shit together. But that other fellow, I'll bet he's got the trains running on time and all his ducks in a row. And techies are just as human as the rest of us. They'll go where they're wanted the most. I've got a suspicion that our adversary wants as many as he can get. Fuck the farmers, he'd just as soon have a few men who can dust off those Idaho missile silos and get them operational again. Ditto tanks and helicopters and maybe a B-52 bomber or two just for chuckles. I doubt if he's gotten that far yet. In fact, I'm sure of it. We'd know. Right now, he's probably still concentrating on getting the power back on, reestablishing communications. Maybe he's even had to indulge in a purge of the faint-hearted. Rome wasn't built in a day, and he'll know that. He has time. But when I watch the sun go down at night, this is no shit, Stuart. I get scared. I don't need bad dreams to scare me anymore. All I have to do is think of them over there on the other side of the Rockies, busy as little bees. What should we be doing? Should I give you a list? Glenn responded, grinning. Stuart gestured at his battered notebook. There were two dancers in silhouette, and the words boogie down on its hot pink cover. Yup, he said. You're kidding. No, I ain't. You said it, Glenn. We gotta start getting our shit together someplace. I feel it, too. It's getting later every day. We can't just sit here jacking off and listening to the CB. We may wake up some morning to find that hard case waltzing into Boulder at the head of an armored column, complete with air support. Don't look for him tomorrow, Glenn said. No, but what about next May? Possible, Glenn said in a low voice. Yes, quite possible. And what do you think would happen to us? Glenn didn't reply with words. He made an explicit little trigger-pulling gesture with the forefinger of his right hand, and then hurriedly scoffed the last of the wine. Yeah, Stu said. So let's start getting it together. Talk. Glenn closed his eyes. The brightening day touched his wrinkled cheeks and forehead. Okay, he said. Here it is, Stu. First, recreate America, little America, by fair means and by foul. Organization and government come first. If it starts now, we can form the sort of government we want. If we wait until the population triples, we are going to have grave problems. Let's say we call a meeting a week from today. That would make it August 18th. Everyone to attend. Before the meeting, there should be an ad hoc organization committee. A committee of seven, let us say. You, me, Andros, Fran, Harold Lauder maybe, a couple more.
The job of the committee would be to create an agenda for the August 18th meeting, and I can tell you right now what some of the items on that agenda should be.
Shoot.
First, reading and ratification of the Declaration of Independence. Second, R&R of the Constitution. Third, R&R of the Bill of Rights. All ratification to be done by voice vote.
Christ, Glenn, we're all Americans.
No, that's where you're wrong, Glenn said, opening his eyes. They looked socketed and bloodshot. We're a bunch of survivors with no government at all. We're a hodgepodge collection from every age group, religious group, class group, and racial group. Government is an idea, Stu. That's really all it is once you strip away the bureaucracy and the bullshit. I'll go further. It's an inculcation, nothing but a memory path worn through the brain. What we've got going for us now is culture lag. Most of these people still believe in government by representation, the republic, what they think of as democracy. But culture lag never lasts long. After a while, they'll start having the gut reactions. The president is dead. The Pentagon is for rent. Nobody is debating anything in the House and the Senate except maybe for the termites and the cockroaches. Our people here are very soon going to wake up to the fact that the old ways are gone and that they can restructure society any old way they want. We need to catch them before they wake up and do something nutty. He leveled his finger at Stu. If someone stood up at the August 18th meeting and proposed that Mother Abigail be put in absolute charge, with you and me and that fellow Andros as her advisors, those people would pass the item by acclamation, blissfully unaware that they had just voted the first operating American dictatorship into power since Huey Long. Oh, I can't believe that. There are college graduates here, lawyers, political activists. Maybe they used to be. Now they're just a bunch of tired, scared people who don't know what's going to happen to them. Some might squawk, but they'd shut up when you told them that Mother Abigail and her advisors were going to get the power back on in 60 days. No, Stu, it's very important that the first thing we do is ratify the spirit of the old society. That's what I meant about recreating America. It has to be that way as long as we're operating under direct threat of the man we're calling the adversary.
Go on.
All right. The next item on the agenda would be that we run the government like a New England township. Perfect democracy. As long as we're relatively small, it'll work fine. Only instead of a board of selectmen, we'll have seven representatives, I guess. Free zone representatives. How does that sound?
It sounds fine.
I think so, too. And we'll see to it that the people who get elected are the same people who are on the ad hoc committee. We'll put the rush on everybody and get the vote taken before people can do any tub-thumping for their friends. We can hand-pick people to nominate us and then second us. The vote will go through as slick as shit through a goose.
That's neat, Stu said admiringly.
Sure, Glenn said glumly.
If you want to short-circuit the democratic process, ask a sociologist.
What's next? This is going to be very popular. The item would read, Resolved, Mother Abigail is to be given absolute veto power over any action proposed by the board.
Jesus, will she agree to that?
I think so. But I don't think she'll ever be apt to exercise her veto power, not in any circumstance I can foresee. We just can't expect to have a workable government here unless we make her its titular head. She's the thing we all have in common. We've all had a paranormal experience that revolves around her. And she has a kind of aura about her. People all use the same loose bunch of adjectives to describe her. Good, kind, old, wise, clever, nice. These people have had one dream that frightens the bejesus out of them, and one that makes them feel safe and secure. They love and trust the source of the good dream all the more because of the dream that frightened them. And we can make it clear to her that she's our leader in name only. I think that's how she'd want it. She's old, tired. Stu was shaking his head.
She's old and tired, but she sees this problem of the dark man as a religious crusade, Glenn. And she's not the only one either, you know that.
You mean she might decide to take the bit in her teeth?
Maybe that wouldn't be so bad, Stu remarked. After all, it was her we dreamed of, not a representative board.
Glenn was shaking his head. No, I can't accept the idea that we're all pawns in some post-apocalypse game of good and evil, dreams or not. God damn it, it's irrational.
Stu shrugged.
Well, let's not get bogged down in it now. I think your idea of giving her veto power is a good one. In fact, I don't think it goes far enough. We ought to give her the power to propose as well as dispose.
But not absolute power on that side of the slate, Glenn said hastily.
No, her ideas would have to be ratified by the representative board, Stu said, and then added slyly, but we might find ourselves a rubber stamp for her instead of the other way around.
There was a long silence. Glenn had put his forehead into one hand. At last, he said,
Yeah, you're right. She can't just be a figurehead. At the very least, we have to accept the possibility that she may have her own ideas. And that's where I pack up my cloudy crystal ball, East Texas, because she's what those of us who ride the sociology range call other-directed.
Who's the other?
God? Thor? Allah? Pee Wee Herman? It doesn't matter. What it means is that what she says won't necessarily be directed by what this society needs or by what its mores turn out to be. She'll be listening to some other voice, like Joan of Arc. What you've made me see is that we just might wind up with a theocracy on our hands here.
Theoc what?
On a god trip, Glenn said. He didn't sound too happy about it.
When you were a little boy, Stu, did you ever dream that you might grow up to be one of seven high priests and or priestesses to a 108-year-old black woman from Nebraska?
Stu stared at him. Finally, he said, Is there any more of that wine?
All gone.
Shit.
Yes, Glenn said. They studied each other's face in silence and then suddenly burst out laughing.
It was surely the nicest house Mother Abigail had ever lived in, and sitting here on the screened-in porch put her in mind of a traveling salesman who had come around Hemmingford back in 1936 or 37. Why, he had been the sweetest-talking fellow she had ever met in her life. He could have charmed the birdies right down from the trees. She had asked this young man, Mr. Donald King by name, what his business was with Abby Freemantle, and he had replied, My business, ma'am, is pleasure. Your pleasure. Do you like to read, listen to the radio, perchance? Or maybe just put your tired old dogs up on a foot hassock and listen to the world as it rolls down the great bowling alley of the universe? She had admitted she enjoyed all those things, not admitting that the Motorola had been sold a month before to pay for 90 bales of hay. Well, those are the things I'm selling, the sweet-talking road merchant had told her. It may be called an Electrolux vacuum cleaner, complete with all the attachments, but what it really is spare time. Plug her in and you open up whole new vistas of relaxation for yourself. And the payments are almost as easy as your housework's going to be. They had been deep in the Depression then. She hadn't even been able to raise 20 cents for hair ribbons for her granddaughter's birthdays, and there was no chance for that Electrolux. But say, didn't that Mr. Donald King of Peru, Indiana, talk sweet? My, she had never seen him again, but she had never forgotten his name either. She just bet he had gone on to break some white lady's heart. She never did own a vacuum cleaner until the end of the Nazi War, when it seemed like all of a sudden anybody could afford anything, and even poor white trash had a mercury hidden away in their back shed. Now this house, which Nick had told her was in the Mapleton Hill section of Boulder. Mother Abigail just bet there hadn't been many blacks living up here before the smiting plague. Had every gadget she'd ever heard of, and some she hadn't. Dishwasher. 2 vacuums. 1 strictly for the upstairs work. Dispose all in the sink. Microwave oven. Clothes washer and dryer. There was a gadget in the kitchen looked like nothing more than a steel box, and Nick's good friend Ralph Brentner told her it was a trash masher, and you could put about 100 pounds of swill into it and get back a little block of garbage about the size of a footstool. Wonders never ceased. But come to think of it, some of them had.
Sitting, rocking on the porch, her eye happened to fall upon an electrical plug-in plate set into the baseboard. Probably so folks could come out here in the summertime and listen to the radio or even have the baseball on that cute little round TV. Nothing in the whole country more common than those little wall plates with the prong slits in them. She'd even had them back in her squatter's shack in Hemmingford. You didn't think nothing of those plates, unless they didn't work anymore. Then you realized that one hell of a lot of person's life came out of them. All that spare time, that pleasure which the long-ago Don King had extolled her on, it came out of those switch plates set into the wall. With their potency taken away, you might as well use all those gadgets like the microwave oven and the trash masher to hang your hat and coat on. Say, her own little house had been better equipped to handle the death of those little switch plates than this one was. Here someone had to bring her water fetched all the way from Boulder Creek, and it had to be boiled before you could use it just for safety's sake. Back home she'd had her own hand pump. Here Nick and Ralph had had to truck up an ugly gadget called a portisan. They had put it in the backyard. At home she'd had her own outhouse. She would have traded the Maytag washer-dryer combination in a second for her own washtub, but she had gotten Nick to find her a new one, and Brad Kitchener had found her a scrub board somewhere and some good old lye soap. They probably thought she was a good old pain in the ass wanting to do her own washing, and so much of it. But cleanly went next to godly. She had never sent her washing out in her whole life, and she didn't mean to start now. She had her little accidents from time to time, too, as old folks often did. But as long as she could do her own wash, those accidents didn't have to be anybody's business but her own. They would get the power back on, of course. It was one of the things God had shown her in her dreams. She knew a goodish number of things about what was to come here, some from the dreams, some from her own common sense. The two were too intertwined to tell apart. Soon all these people would stop running around like chickens with their heads cut off and start pulling together. She was not a sociologist like that Glenn Bateman, who always eyed her like a racetrack agent looking at a phony 10, but she knew that people always did pull together after a while. The curse and blessing of the human race was its chumminess. Why, if six people went floating down the Mississippi on a church roof in a flood, they'd start a bingo game as soon as the roof grounded on a sandbar. First they'd want to form some sort of government, probably one they'd want to run around her. She couldn't allow that, of course, as much as she would like to. That would not be God's will. Let them run all the things that had to do with this earth. Get the power back on? Fine. First thing she was going to do was try out that trash masher. Get the gas running so they wouldn't freeze their behinds off this winter. Let them pass their resolutions and make their plans. That was fine. She would keep her nose right out of that part. She would insist that Nick have a part in the running of it, and maybe Ralph. That Texan seemed all right. He knew enough to shut off his mouth when his brains weren't running. She supposed they might want that fat boy, that Harold, and she wouldn't stop them. But she didn't like him. Harold made her nervous, all the time grinning, but the grin never touched his eyes. He was pleasant, he said the right things, but his eyes were like two cold flints poking out of the ground. She thought that Harold had some kind of secret, some smelly, nasty thing all wrapped up in a stinking poultice in the middle of his heart. She had no idea what it might be. It was not God's will for her to see that, so it must not matter to his plan for this community. All the same, it troubled her to think that fat boy might be a part of their high councils, but she would say nothing. Her business, she thought rather complacently in her rocker, her place in their councils and deliberations had only to do with the dark man. He had no name, although it pleased him to call himself Flag, at least for the time being, and on the far side of the mountains his work was already well begun. She did not know his plans. They were as veiled from her eyes as whatever secrets lay in that fat boy Harold's heart. But she did not have to know the specifics. His goal was clear and simple, to destroy all of them. Her understanding of him was surprisingly sophisticated. The people who had been drawn to the free zone all came to see her in this place, and she received them, although they sometimes made her tired.
and they all wanted to tell her that they had dreamed of her and of him. They were terrified of him, and she nodded and comforted and soothed as best she could, but privately she thought that most of them wouldn't know this flag if they met him on the street, unless he wanted to be noticed. They might feel him,